I want to begin this message by reading from an article that I found not too long ago. It is titled "The Cobalt Pipeline," and a subtitle, "Tracing the Path from Deadly Hand-Dug Mines in Congo to Consumers' Phones and Laptops." This is from the Washington Post, written by Todd Frankel with contributions from Peter Worisky, and it was written or published on September 30th, 2016, so just a week and a half or so ago. It begins with this. The sun was rising over one of the richest mineral deposits on earth in one of the poorest countries as Siddiqui Mayamba got ready for work. Mayamba is a cobalt miner, and the red dirt savanna stretching outside his door contains such an astonishing wealth of cobalt and other minerals that a geologist once described it as a scandal geologic. So a scandal of geologic proportions, basically, or of geology. Goes on to say, this remote landscape in southern Africa lies at the heart of the world's mad scramble for cheap cobalt, a mineral essential to the rechargeable lithium-ion batteries that power smartphones, laptops, and electric vehicles made by companies such as Apple, Samsung, and major automakers. But Mayamba, 35, knew nothing about his role in this sprawling global supply chain. He grabbed his metal shovel and broken-headed hammer from a corner of the room he shares with his wife and child. He pulled on a dust-stained jacket. A proud man, he likes to wear a button-down shirt, even to mine. And he planned to mine by hand all day and through the night. He would nap in the underground tunnels. No industrial tools. Not even a hard hat. The risk of a cave-in is constant. Do you have enough money to buy flour today? He asked his wife. She did. But now, a debt collector stood at the door. The family owed money for salt. Flour would have to wait. Mayamba tried to reassure his wife. He said goodbye to his son. Then he slung his shovel over his shoulder. It was time. The world's soaring demand for cobalt is at times met by workers, including children, who labor in harsh and dangerous conditions. An estimated 100,000 cobalt miners in Congo alone. And they use hand tools to dig hundreds of feet underground with little oversight and few safety measures, according to workers, government officials, and evidence found by the Washington Post during visits to remote mines. Deaths and injuries are common, and the mining activity exposes local communities to levels of toxic metals that appear to be linked to ailments that include breathing problems and birth defects, health officials say. The article goes on to say, the diggers are desperate, said Pappy Nsaga, a digger and president of a fledgling diggers union. Pay is based on what they find. No minerals, no money. And the money is meager, the equivalent of $2 to $3 a day on a good day. And Sega said, we shouldn't have to live like this. As I said, I found that in the Washington Post. I have a free subscription to that online. I don't read it every day, but this article caught my attention as I was scrolling through the headlines, as I said, about a week and a half ago. It got me thinking about today and how desperately this world needs what this day, the Day of Atonement, pictures. But it wasn't just that article. Just about any time you pick up a newspaper, turn on the television news, or look at news on the internet, you will find stories that reinforce how much this world needs God's intervention. Take this Reuters article from just a few days ago, for example. The storyline here is from Port-au-Prince, Haiti, on October 9th. It says patients arrived every 10 to 15 minutes, brought on motorcycles by relatives with vomit-covered shoulders and hoisted up the stairs into southwest Haiti's Port-au-Prince hospital, where they could rest their weak, cholera-sapped limbs. Less than a week since Hurricane Matthew slammed into Haiti, killing at least 1,000 people, according to a tally of numbers from local officials, devastated corners of the country are facing a public health crisis as cholera gallops through rural communities, lacking clean water, food, and shelter. Reuters visited the Port-au-Prince hospital early on Sunday morning, the first day southwestern Haiti's main coastal road had become semi-navigable by car. At that time, there were 39 cases of cholera, according to Missol Antoine, the hospital's medical director. By the early afternoon, there were nearly 60, and 4 people had died of the waterborne illness. That number is going to rise, Antoine said, as she rushed between patients laid out on the hospital floor. Inside the hospital, grim-faced parents cradled young children whose eyes had sunk back and were unable to prop up their own heads. I believe in the doctors and also in God, said 37-year-old Roosevelt Dume, holding the head of his son rudely as he tried to remain upbeat. Out on the streets, the scene was also shocking. For miles on end, almost all the houses were reduced to little more than rubble and twisted metal. Colorful clothes were littered among the chaos. The region's banana crop was destroyed, with vast fields of plantain flattened into a leafy mush. With neither government nor foreign aid arriving quickly, people relied on felled coconuts for food and water. The stench of death, be it human or animal, was everywhere. Diarrhea-stricken residents in the village of Chevalier were well aware of the nearby cholera outbreak, but had little option except to drink the brackish water from the local well that they believed was already contaminated by dead livestock. We have been abandoned by a government that never thinks of us, said Marie Henry as she surveyed her smashed home. She said Chevalier had yet to receive any aid, and many, like her, were coming down with fever. Cholera, she feared, was on its way. I believe in the doctors and also in God, the man said. But how can the average man understand why these things take place? We generally look at and think about these kinds of things on the Feast of Trumpets to show how much the world needs the return of Jesus Christ. We look at the events that are portrayed by that day and see how awful it will be, and yet these things are happening today all around the world, and this is just a small sampling. So why read these today? Let's turn to Leviticus 23. I know we spent a bit of time in Leviticus already this afternoon, but we're going to spend quite a bit more time there in this message as well. I want to read the instructions that God gave Israel for keeping the Day of Atonement. And I think it is appropriate to begin our discussion of the Day of Atonement here. We're going to read verses 27 through 32 very familiar words. Leviticus 23, beginning in verse 27. Also the 10th day of this 7th month shall be the Day of Atonement. It shall be a holy convocation for you. You shall afflict your souls and offer an offering made by fire to the Lord. And you shall do no work on that same day, for it is the Day of Atonement, to make atonement for you before the Lord your God. For any person who is not afflicted in soul on that same day shall be cut off from his people. And any person who does any work on that same day, that person I will destroy from among his people. You shall do no manner of work. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings. It shall be to you a Sabbath of solemn rest, and you shall afflict your souls on the 9th day of the month at even. From evening to evening, you shall celebrate your Sabbaths. If we turn back a few pages, back to Leviticus chapter 16, there is quite a bit more written about this day, as we talked about in the first message. In fact, the whole chapter is about what is to be done on the Day of Atonement. And we're pretty much going to read the whole chapter as we go on today. We're going to begin, however, in verses 29 through 34, Leviticus 16, verses 29 through 34. Here we read, "This shall be a statute forever for you. In the 7th month, on the 10th day of the month, you shall afflict your souls and do no work at all. Whether a native of your own country or a stranger who dwells among you, for on that day the priest shall make atonement for you to cleanse you, that you may be clean from all your sins before the Lord." In his sermon last week, Clay mentioned this, that all of the activities that took place on the Day of Atonement, for the most part, were performed by the priest. There were no physical activities for the average person to perform, not even eating. They were to do no work at all. Verse 31, it says, "It is a Sabbath of solemn rest to you, and you shall afflict your souls. It is a statute forever, and the priest who is anointed and consecrated to minister as priest in his father's place," I'm talking about the high priest here, "shall make atonement and put on the linen clothes, the holy garments. Then he shall make atonement for the holy sanctuary, and he shall make atonement for the tabernacle of meeting and for the altar, and he shall make atonement for the priests and for all the people of the assembly. This shall be an everlasting statute for you to make atonement for the children of Israel for all their sins once a year." So while the average person was not to perform any work whatsoever, the high priest had quite a bit of work to do, didn't he? Let's take a look at some of what the priest was to do in order to make atonement on that day. I know we read through some of this, but I don't think it hurts to go through it again. To do so, we can go back to the beginning of this chapter and begin reading in verse 1. So Leviticus chapter 16, verse 1. "Now the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, when they offered profane fire before the Lord and died. And the Lord said to Moses, 'Tell Aaron your brother not to come in at just any time into the holy place inside the veil, before the mercy seat which is on the ark, lest he die, for I will appear in the cloud above the mercy seat.'" I find it interesting that these instructions are only given after the death of Aaron's two sons. Why is that mentioned in the context for what follows? Did they have unfettered access to the holy place before? Was it only after they sinned as priests then that they needed to come and make atonement for themselves? I don't really know the answers, but I find it interesting. I tend to think that there may be something in the fact that they may have had more access previously. I can't prove that. But if all of what God gave Israel in regards to the tabernacle and the duties that were performed were just a symbol of things to come, maybe there was more access previous to that. I don't really know. Let's move on. I'm sorry I got distracted there, but we'll continue on. Just that's been going through my head, so as I said, I find it interesting. Verse 3, thus Aaron shall come into the holy place with the blood of a young bull as a sin offering and of a ram as a burnt offering. He shall put the holy linen tunic and the linen trousers on his body. He shall be girded with a linen sash, and with the linen turban he shall be attired. These are holy garments. Therefore he shall wash his body in water and put them on. Before we continue, I want to try and clarify some of the order here. Verse 3 talks about some of the offerings that were to be made. However, it seems that the order, the order is that the priest was to wash his body in water and then put on the holy garments first. The offerings then were to be made after that, as we see beginning in verse 11. You also see where it talks about the bull as the offering, and then it goes into, as we move on, it talks about the two kids and of the goats and the ram is the burnt offering, and then it kind of goes back again. So it looks like, you know, it's explaining what's to be brought there as sacrifices, but it's not giving the specific order in these first few verses. As I mentioned, it looks like then that the beginning of this is where Aaron or the high priest after him was to wash his body and then put on these clothes. I think there's probably a lesson in there for us, just as he was to clean himself the best he could before coming to God with the sin offering to make atonement for himself and for his house, that we too need to do our part to clean ourselves up before asking God to forgive us when we sin. Let's continue in verse 5. It says, and he shall take from the congregation of the children of Israel two kids of the goats as a sin offering and one ram as a burnt offering. For now, we're going to move on from that. I know Chuck did talk a little bit about those two goats. We're going to skip down to verse 11, where we'll continue looking at the work of the high priest. Says, and Aaron, in verse 11, and Aaron shall bring the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement for himself and for his house, and shall kill the bull as a sin offering, which is for himself. Then he shall take a censer full of burning coals of fire from the altar before the Lord, with his hands full of sweet incense, beaten fine, and bring it inside the veil. And he shall put the incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is on the testimony, lest he die. He shall take some of the blood of the bull and sprinkle it with his finger on the mercy seat on the east side, and before the mercy seat he shall sprinkle some of the blood with his finger 7 times. Then he shall kill the goat of the sin offering, which is for the people, bring its blood inside the veil, do with that blood as he did with the blood of the bull, and sprinkle it on the mercy seat and before the mercy seat. So he shall make atonement for the holy place because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel and because of their transgressions for all their sins. And so he shall do for the tabernacle of meeting, which remains among them in the midst of their uncleanness. In verse 18, and he shall go out to the altar that is before the Lord and make atonement for it, and shall take some of the blood of the bull and some of the blood of the goat and put it on the horns of the altar all around. Then he shall sprinkle some of the blood on it with his finger 7 times, cleanse it, and consecrate it from the uncleanness of the children of Israel. And when he has made an end of atoning for the holy place, the tabernacle of meeting, and the altar, he shall bring the live goat. And once again, we're going to skip over those activities for now and continue with verse 23. Then Aaron shall come into the tabernacle of meeting, shall take off the linen garments which he put on when he went into the holy place, and shall leave them there. And he shall wash his body with water in a holy place, put on his garments, come out and offer his burnt offering and the burnt offering of the people, and make atonement for himself and for the people. There are a couple of things worth mentioning here. First, up until this time, it was the blood that was used to make atonement for the holy place, the altar, and the tabernacle of meeting. It was only after that that the burnt offering was made for the atonement of the priest himself and for the people. The other thing that is interesting is that the clothes he wore for all of this was different from his normal priestly garb. You might remember when the instructions were given for them to make the clothing for the priests that they were very decorative. Here, it's a little bit different. These clothes, the clothes that he wore here, it is believed by many, are more plain and more in harmony with the season of humiliation, which is this time period from trumpets through atonement. Barnes says this. He says, in preparing to enter the Holy of Holies, he attired himself in spotless white as a token of the holiness without which none, in a spiritual sense, can enter the divine presence. So let's continue then in verse 27 this time. The bull for the sin offering and the goat for the sin offering, whose blood was brought in to make atonement in the holy place, shall be carried outside the camp. And they shall burn in the fire their skins, their flesh, and their offal. Then he who burns them shall wash his clothes and bathe his body in water, and afterwards he may come into the camp. Just a quick note here that there are then at least one other or two other people that do some work on that day, even though they were told to do no work. The priest, certainly, the high priest, the man who took the goat into the wilderness, and the person who then took, that burned the offerings here. Verse 29, this shall be a statute forever for you in the 7th month, on the 10th day of the month. You shall afflict your souls and do no work at all, whether a native of your own country or a stranger who dwells among you. For on that day the priest shall make atonement for you to cleanse you, that you may be clean from all your sins before the Lord. And that pretty much brings us back to where we started in this chapter. I'd like you to turn to the book of Hebrews next. And we'll spend some more time looking, or spend some time looking at how all of this does apply to us today. We're going to begin in chapter 2, Hebrews chapter 2. So far, we have really only looked at instructions given in ancient Israel to Aaron the high priest and to those who were to follow after him, and specifically in regard to what he was to do on the Day of Atonement. But in order for us to fully understand how it all applies to us, we need to first understand where Jesus Christ fits into all of this. And that is what Hebrews is really all about. So we begin here in Hebrews chapter 2, verses 14 through 17, where we learn a bit about Jesus Christ's purpose and role. Verse 14, inasmuch then as the children, those who need to be redeemed, all of us, inasmuch as then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is, the devil, and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. For indeed, he does not give aid to angels, but he does give aid to the seed of Abraham. Therefore, in all things, he had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. In other words, Jesus Christ became flesh and blood because we are, so that he could become a merciful and faithful high priest to make atonement for our sins and to reconcile us to God. It also includes overcoming Satan, but right now we're focusing on his role as the high priest. And that includes making atonement, reconciliation, or propitiation. In the next chapter, we are told that we need to understand that Jesus Christ is not just our high priest, but our most worthy spiritual leader. He replaces even Moses in that regard, and Israel holds no man higher in regard than Moses. Hebrews 3, beginning in verse 1. Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our confession, Christ Jesus, who was faithful to him who appointed him, as Moses also was faithful in all his house. For this one has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, inasmuch as he who built the house has more honor than the house. We are told then that as he is greater even than Moses, we too must be better than the Israelites who were in the wilderness. In what way? Well, let's move down to verses 12 and 13, where we read, Beware, brethren, lest there be any of you, or in any of you, an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God, but exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. And then in verses 18 and 19, it says, Beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief and departing from the living God, but exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. I'm sorry, I went back up, didn't I? Verses 18 and 19, it says, And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who did not obey? So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. So we need to truly, wholeheartedly, completely believe. They were not able to enter into the promised land because of their unbelief and disobedience. We need to do better. And we need to help each other do better, as it says in verse 13. Let's jump ahead to chapter 4 and read verses 9 through 11. I want to explore something for a moment here that relates, I think, to the instructions for keeping the Day of Atonement. It says here, there remains therefore a rest for the people of God. Talked about a rest in the previous chapter, in chapter 3, verse 18. But here it says, there remains therefore a rest for the people of God. For he who has entered his rest has himself also ceased from his works, as God did from his. Let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall according to the same example of disobedience. So this talks about a rest for the people of God, a rest for Jesus Christ, and it refers to a rest by God. Now, generally, we think of this rest in terms of the kingdom, at least for the people of God. But I think that there is a relationship also to the Day of Atonement. Remember the instructions that we read earlier in Leviticus 23? You don't need to turn back there. Let me read through it again real quick. It says, also on the 10th day of the 7th month shall be a Day of Atonement. It shall be a holy convocation for you. You shall afflict your souls and offer an offering made by fire to the Lord. And you shall do no work on that same day, for it is the Day of Atonement, to make atonement for you before the Lord your God. Verse 29, it says, for any person who is not afflicted in soul that day shall be cut off from his people, and any person who does any work on that same day, that person I will destroy from among his people. You shall do no manner of work. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations. In all your dwellings it shall be to you a Sabbath of solemn rest, and you shall afflict your souls on the 9th day of the month at evening. From evening to evening you shall celebrate your Sabbath. No work. Otherwise they would be cut off and destroyed. What work are we to stop doing today? Sure, this is a Sabbath day and we do refrain from work. Let's read Hebrews 4 verses 9 through 11 again. It says, there remains therefore a rest for the people of God. For he who has entered his rest has himself also ceased from his work as God did from his. Let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall according to the same example of disobedience. What is the work that God rested from? And what is the work that Jesus ceased from doing? Wasn't it all physical work? God rested after he created man and all of the other physical things that we read about in the first chapter of Genesis. They didn't stop from doing any work. They stopped from doing physical works for the most part. The work they are doing now is different. It is all spiritually related. Jesus Christ gave up his physical existence. He ceased his physical works and yet carries on in working daily for all of us and through all of us. We too need to stop with some works. We need to cease doing the works of the flesh as described in Galatians 5, 19 through 21. Those are the works. Those works. We need to enter that same rest that Jesus Christ and God have rendered into. We can't do that completely at this time, but we need to do everything that we can at this point to enter that rest. So let's continue here in Hebrews chapter 4, verses 14 through 16. Here we are told that we are not lost because of those works of our past. Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confessions. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. We have hope. Our high priest understands us and our weaknesses. He was just like us. And he will help us to make it through. Let's jump ahead again, this time to Hebrews chapter 6, verses 19 and 20. There is something I want to explore here for a bit regarding this hope that we have. I like the picture that these words portray. This hope we have as an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, and which enters the presence behind the veil, where the forerunner has entered for us, even Jesus, having become high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. As I said, I like the picture that these words portray, and they also tie us back to the Day of Atonement. This hope we have as an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast. I want to read a portion of what it says in Robertson's word pictures about this verse. In regard to the words as an anchor of the soul, it says, "The ancient anchors were much like the modern ones, with iron hooks to grapple the rocks and so hold on to prevent shipwreck." You've all seen what an anchor looks like. And a good anchor will hold a ship, will not let it go. Will grab a hold of the rocks. I've seen boats that let out their anchor in just sand and didn't make sure that it got a good hold. And the next morning they were on the shore. Then goes on to say about both sure and steadfast, that this anchor of hope will not slip or lose its grip. It is trustworthy. And then that which is within the veil, it says, the Holy of Holies, the inner part of the veil, the space behind the veil. The anchor is out of sight, but it holds. That is what matters. You might say that our anchor of hope holds on to our rock, which is Christ. He is in the real holy place and cannot be moved. As long as we do not let go of our anchor, we will be sure, we will be safe. Behind the veil also brings us back to this day. To fully understand that, let's go to chapter 9, Hebrews chapter 9. Again, we're going to read much of the chapter here, but we'll begin in verse 1, Hebrews 9, verse 1. "Then indeed, even the first covenant had ordinance of divine service and the earthly sanctuary. For a tabernacle was prepared, the first part, in which was the lampstand, the table, and the showbread, which is called the sanctuary. And behind the second veil, the part of the tabernacle, which is called the holiest of all, or the holy place, or the holy of holies, which had the golden censer and the ark of the covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, in which were the golden pot that had the manna, Aaron's rod that budded, and the tablets of the covenant. And above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these things we cannot speak in detail now." It says, "Now, when these things had been thus prepared, the priest always went into the first part of the tabernacle performing the services. But into the second part, the high priest went alone once a year. On this day, the Day of Atonement, as we've read already, not without blood, which he offered for himself and for the people's sins, committed in ignorance." This is showing us, again, the physical tabernacle and the activities that were to take place, and primarily then focusing on the events that take place on this day, or that were to take place on the Day of Atonement. We've read what was to happen on this day already. But the physical is just a representation of the spiritual. So we'll continue reading here. I'll go back to verse 7 again. But into the second part of the high priest went alone once a year, not without blood, which he offered for himself and for the people's sins committed in ignorance. The Holy Spirit indicating this, that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest while the first tabernacle was still standing. So there's a change, and we know that. It goes on to say, it was symbolic for the present time, in which both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make him who performed the service perfect in regard to the conscience. Concerned only with food and drinks, various washings, the fleshly ordinances imposed until the time of Reformation. But Christ came as high priest of the good things to come, with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands. That is, not of this creation, not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood, he entered the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. Verse 24. For Christ has not entered the holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear at the presence of God for us. Not that he should offer himself often, as the high priest enters the holy place every year with blood of another. He then would have to, had to suffer often since the foundation of the world, but now, once at the end of the ages, he has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And as it is appointed for men to die once, but after this the judgment, so Christ was offered once to bear the sins of many. To those who eagerly wait for him, he will appear a second time, apart from sin, for salvation. And yes, we certainly do look forward to that. It's easy for us, when we read these things, to see how important this day is and what it means to us. But what about those people in the article that I read earlier? How does it apply to them? There are, as I'm sure you're aware, a couple of things that I haven't looked at in all of this. Chuck covered some of those already, things that were to take place on this day. So let's look back just very briefly at Leviticus chapter 16 again. I'm not going to cover much of this, as we already did see quite a bit of it. But I do want to read verses 7 through 10 and just add a little bit to what Chuck mentioned earlier in his message. Leviticus 16, verse 7 reads, he shall take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Then Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one lot for the Lord and the other for the scapegoat, or the Azazel. And Aaron shall bring the goat on which the Lord's lot fell and offer it as a sin offering, which we've talked about. But the goat on which the lot fell, to be the Azazel goat, shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement upon it and to let it go as the Azazel into the wilderness. I just want to add, it's interesting when you look up this word, Azazel. It's a difficult word to be translated. In fact, in Brown Driver Biggs, it says, the meaning is dubious. Says that it is, or it refers to the goat used for sacrifice for the sins of the people, scapegoat, entire removal. In both Strong's and here, it says that it is related to two other words. It really comes from these two other words together. One is, and I forget what it is, Zal, I think, or Zay, maybe, I think is what it is. The word 5795 in Strong's, and that is a she-goat. I find that kind of interesting. The other word is number 235, Azal, and it can mean to go away, or to go to and fro. And I found that interesting. So when you put them together, it's a she-goat that goes to and fro. It is not the male goat or lamb that we associate necessarily with Christ. And I know there's different ways of looking at what these two goats represent, but I think it's interesting when you put it this way, a she-goat that goes to and fro, which seems to me that it refers to Satan in an awful lot of ways. And as Chuck mentioned, in regard to taking it out into the wilderness and what we see later in Revelation. The other thing that happens on this day is found in Leviticus chapter 25. I'd like to read a few verses there. God told Israel that they should have a land rest every 7 years. And then it says, beginning here in verse 8, we're going to read verses 8 through 13, and it says, "And you shall count 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, and the time of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. Then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. You shall make the trumpet to sound throughout all your land. And you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his possession, and each of you shall return to his family. That 50th year shall be a jubilee to you, in that you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of its own accord, nor gather the grapes of your unintended or untended vine. For it is the Jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You shall eat its produce from the field. In this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his possession." It is a release from captivity for all of the people. That's part of what is pictured by this day. I don't know if that was ever carried out in ancient Israel. We see that part of the punishment when they went into captivity was that the land was going to remain empty to make up for the times that they did not keep their land rests or jubilee as they were supposed to for 70 years. What's that equal out to in Jubilees? 350 years worth of time that they did not do what they were asked to do? When I read these articles, I can't help but feel that this world is held in captivity today. And they are desperately in need of release. There was one other article that I ran across. I saw it yesterday, and again, it's from the Washington Post by Katie Mettler. It was the headline that caught my attention. 5 dead teens, a stolen cop car, and the most horrific crash in decades. Says the first 911 call came in at 11:43 p.m. Saturday. A report from a concerned motorist about a Toyota truck barreling down Interstate 89 on the wrong side of the road. More calls followed, and more after that. Vermont state and local police dispatched cruisers hoping to intercept the erratic driver to stop the truck before a crash did. They drove alongside motorists who couldn't possibly know the danger speeding toward them and carloads of people they had no way of warning. Among them was a Volkswagen Jetta carrying five teenagers barely old enough to drive. 9 minutes later, at 11:53, police received another 911 call. This time it was about a crash. The first police officer on scene in Williston, found two crumpled vehicles in the road, a Toyota truck and a Volkswagen Jetta. The Jetta was engulfed in flames. In a desperate attempt to save the teenagers trapped inside, the officer grabbed a fire extinguisher and rushed toward the blaze, according to the Vermont State Police. He pulled one young girl from the car and tried to suppress the flames. Then he watched this scene in disbelief. His police cruiser, the red and blue emergency light still activated, was speeding away from the wreckage. Behind the wheel sat a man later identified as Stephen Burgoyne, 36, the apparent owner of the wrong-way truck. By night's end, Burgoyne had not only hijacked the officer's car but dodged police custody while fleeing the scene, hitting at least seven other cars while driving the wrong way along Interstate 89, according to the authorities. His spree ended only when he crashed the police cruiser for a final time, police said, ejecting himself from the car before it, too, burst into flames. He was rushed to the hospital alongside five other people, police said, who were reported to be in stable condition, all five teenagers, friends since childhood on their way home from a concert, were killed. It says nearly 1,000 people gathered Monday night at Harwood Union High School to mourn the five teens killed in the crash. At the vigil, the mass of students released paper lanterns in the sky and wept. How do you deal with these things? If you don't know what God has planned, it is hard. It's even hard sometimes for us to understand completely. But this world is not our world. This world is not now controlled by God or Jesus Christ, his Son. This world desperately needs what this day pictures. A release from the captivity of Satan. A release from his slavery. We see that release. Chuck read about it, but I think I'd like to finish by going back to Revelation chapter 20. We'll read verses 1 through 3. This takes place after Christ's return, after the events we associate with the Feast of Trumpets. Time we desperately need and look forward to. A time that isn't for us, but for the rest of the world. We have a part in it. We'll be there to help. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. Oh, how I desperately look for that time. pictured for the world by what we're celebrating here today. Godspeed that time. Thank you.